Thanks for joining us. We're going to get started. I'll give you a quick heads up. We had to change the time today. We're on the road traveling. We're in New Mexico trying to make it back to Oregon for the weekend. So I need to get some miles in today. Calls are really, really light because we moved the time and maybe the holiday weekend. This is your opportunity. If you have a question, a comment, a topic, anything at all that you want to talk about, press one on your phone. I guarantee we'll get to you. There's a good chance we're only going to do an hour today unless the calls pick up. So we'll go ahead and get started and I'll keep you updated. But right now, wide open, if you want to talk about anything at all, go ahead and press one on your phone. Let's get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. My co-host is Kim Cockerham. We're going to take your calls and answer your questions about everything health, fitness, nutrition, exercise, training, drugs, disease, mostly about how to get and stay healthy on the road, living in a truck, and not always having access to the best food, but we're going to give you some tips and ideas. I've got a book review today. We're going to talk about that, and then we're going to get to your calls and questions. Kim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Kevin. Glad to be here.
Well, great to have you here. Hey, I guess you have some exciting news for us, don't you?
I do. Finally. This was the scary, you know, take a step in faith going forward. And I faxed off my registration for the NTC program, which is a step back from the NTP that you did. So that'll start September 19th. And it's just been, you know, it's all of our listeners, it's all of our callers, you know, so many people that I've been talking to with supplements and with the health show. And I just, I know this is something I wanted to do to better serve them and let's truck and learn more myself and grow. And so I'm excited.
Well, that's awesome. So NTC, Nutritional Therapy Consultant, and then an NTP, a Nutritional Therapy Practitioner. Everything you're going to learn was part of the NTP program. The only thing that you're really not going to learn was the physical hands-on evaluation. That's the only difference. Everything, all the books, you're going to read all the same books. You're going to have all the same testing. You're going to get all the same information except that last one piece, which is the what they call the functional evaluation, which... You know what? I'll teach you that. So, I mean, you'll have the equivalent of the NTP anyway. Now, in the NTC, you have one weekend workshop that you have to go to. Is that correct?
Yeah. It'll be the first weekend of December. I'll be in Boston for that. So, and what it was
Boston.
Really important to me to see that I could take this, and you can then go and complete the functional evaluation and up, you know, and then get to the NTP.
Right.
So they've really created a great course, and it's nice that they made that an option to do it that way. Because that was one of my issues too, was just having to be, you know, the cost and then having to be away, you know, that many weekends like you did.
Right.
Yeah,
the NTP, there were three workshop weekends. And most of that time, 90% of the time we spent in the workshops was the hands-on, learning that functional evaluation. So, well, that's exciting. That's really exciting.
I'm
looking forward to it. It's going to be fun to watch because so much of this is going to be familiar to you because this is what we've been talking about and doing. And I think it'll be, you're going to love start to see it all come together that way.
Yeah, I'm excited. So thanks for your support. That's awesome.
Yeah. So a couple things. One, just in general about the trucking industry, health is starting to become an issue. You know, we're seeing it a lot more at the Great American Truck Show. There was a big health fair. I see more and more people in the industry talking about health, and it's certainly necessary. Unfortunately, I'm a little disappointed, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised. The trucking industry is kind of behind the times on almost everything. You know, I deal with several different industries, being a financial planner and doing that, being involved on the tax and accounting side, and now the health industry, and I follow a lot of technology, and things move. In most industries today, things are moving so fast, it's hard to keep up with them. You know, if you're in the tech industry, that's probably the worst. I mean, things change so fast. And, you know, in many industries, you kind of need to be on that cutting edge. But the trucking industry is kind of behind. It doesn't change very fast. It's a very slow-moving industry when it comes to change. And, you know, part of it is they're fighting with a lot of the change in trucking itself, with regulations and truck technology changing. My disappointment on the health side is they're really using a lot of very old, outdated advice that we now know just doesn't work. In fact, some of it does more damage. You know, the whole idea that they sold us on for decades, the low-fat, you know, high-carb diet, was really what caused many of our problems, and yet that is still being promoted. And, you know, I was excited to see the health fair, and Lisa and I kind of had a goal to go through the health fair and to create one new partnership. You know, the way we do on the truck side, we go look for what we think is the best of the best in any category, and then we build that relationship and bring those things to the listeners. And our goal was, you know, to start doing that on the health side, which we're already doing. We have some great partnerships already. But we thought we'd find some there. And honestly, I walked through the whole health fair and looked at all the vendors, and there wasn't even one I was interested in talking to. I mean, not even one vendor in that health fair that made me want to go talk to them. I was disappointed in that. The other thing is they're really still heavily promoting a couple things that I'm really against. One is medical screenings. And I know people have a hard time understanding why I would be against this, but I've read enough books and looked at enough statistics that I can promise you I will never do a medical screening of any kind. And let's just define what a screening is. When we use the word medical screening, we're talking about taking some sort of a test or doing some sort of a procedure to look for a disease when there are no symptoms present. That's a clear distinction. If you have symptoms, then you should find out what those symptoms are and try to fix it. But there is a huge industry in medical screening that says we're going to go look for a disease even though you have no symptoms. And we've all heard the recommendations. After 40, you should have this test done. You know, after 50, you should have this test done every year. You should have mammograms. You should have prostate screenings. I mean, on and on and on and on. And there's more and more of them all the time. And I know people will say, and we've been sold on this, that this is just a wonderful thing. We're going to go find the disease before you ever even know you have it, before you have any symptoms. And the earlier we find it, the better our chances of curing it, although the medical community doesn't cure much of anything. And people would say, well, why would that be a bad thing? You know, if you find something, that'd be wonderful, and you can treat it, and maybe you'll save a life. And if you don't find anything, big deal. You know, what have you lost? The problem is these screenings are just huge money makers. And that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to make a lot of money. So these companies will come into an area. They'll flood the area with marketing, billboards, TV ads, radio ads, and say, we have free prostate cancer screenings, you know, this weekend. And people think, oh, well, it's free, you know, no big deal. Maybe I'll find something early. And they go in and do the screenings. And there are some horrible, horrible stories of what happens to people once they get in the system. So the system is designed, they're going to find something in the majority of people. And the reason they find something is to move you to the next step of the process, which isn't free. So the free part is really just to get you into the system. The problem comes in with a lot of false positives and this mentality that they want to keep moving you to the next test. And that's how they keep making money. And it's just really not a good idea. These screening programs, yes, they do catch some cancers once in a while, but the numbers are not good. When you look at the statistics and you look at how many false positives, how many people go through all kinds of procedures, prostate screening is one of the worst. The numbers on that are horrendous. They use this PSA number that has no good correlation to cancer whatsoever. If you don't do well on the PSA number, then they want a biopsy. But there's a real problem with trying to biopsy a prostate. We'll talk about that in a second and more screenings in general. And I have a book recommendation, then we're going to get to some of your calls and questions. Stick around. We'll be right back. This is Destination Health. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. Kim Cockerham is here with me, and we're talking right now about medical screenings and why they're, I really think, a bad idea. So the problem on this prostate screening, especially, you do the PSA test, your number's high. They say, okay, we want to do a biopsy. The problem is they don't know where to biopsy on most organs. If they're going to do a biopsy, they can see the spot that they believe might be cancerous, and that's where they put the needle in and withdraw the cells and check for cancer. In the prostate, they can't see it. And they actually put the needle in 12 random places to pull out cells. Uh-huh. And even then, they're not sure how accurate that is. And that's a pretty invasive procedure. And what they found is that all men, virtually all men, if you live beyond somewhere around 60, I think, all men will die with prostate cancer, but not from prostate cancer. Cancerous cells in the prostate are kind of common, but most of them are very, very slow growing, so slow growing that they never cause a problem. And I could go on and on about the problems with mammograms, the problem with chest x-rays, the problem with these whole body scans. Those are a horrible idea. The whole body scan, which again, they come in, set it up, say they can detect all these different problems by doing this heart whole body scan. The reason they're worse is they're going to find all kinds of stuff on that whole body scan. And then you have to start doing more individual tests to find out what all those little anomalies were. And most of the time, the vast majority of the time, the things they see on these scans turn out to be nothing. The other downside to these is again, they're designed to show something so that they can move you to the next stage, which is where they make the money, and then the next stage and the next stage. And even if you come out of all of these tests with negatives, what about the stress of going through all of this, the cost, the time, the pain sometimes, and then the worry about, oh my God, I do have something, I'm going to die. So I just think we're far better off not doing these random screenings. And if you get symptoms, then go in and do some sort of a screening. There's a huge industry, and they were promoting this fairly heavily at the truck show. That's why I'm bringing it up now. They had, you know, the mammogram unit there, and they were, you know, really encouraging people to go through these screenings. And I just really think it's a bad idea. The other thing I see the trucking industry promoting heavily, several groups in the trucking industry do this every year, and it's coming up again, flu vaccines. I think they are a horrible idea. I will never get a flu vaccine. I can promise you that. And again, I could go through all the reasons why. For one, there are dozens and dozens of strains of flu that go around every year, and the vaccine is usually only for one. They're only vaccinating you for one strain that they think might be the one that causes all the problems this year. But by the time we figure out which one it is, it's usually too late, and that's not the one they're vaccinating for. There, we have adverse reactions. Again, this is another big moneymaker, but we have groups out there that are in the trucking industry heavily promoting getting these flu vaccines. You know, it's interesting that we have what we call the flu season. And, you know, I grew up where you did in Ohio. You mm-hmm. have winter, and people tend to get more sick in the wintertime. That was always the feeling. So it was like flu season kind of starts, you know, around November or so and runs through February or March. So that's when they're always talking about the vaccines. But then the interesting thing was I moved from Ohio to Florida. Didn't you do that too?
Yeah. Yep. And I know where you're going with this, because I was thinking about that too. Yeah.
Yeah, so they talk about the fact that you get more sick in the wintertime because, you know, cold weather's harder on your body, but the house is all closed up, cars are all closed up, offices are all closed up, and we're surrounded by all these germs, and that's why we get sick in the wintertime. Then I thought, wait a minute, after living in Florida for a couple of years, Florida's the exact opposite. Florida, this time of year, winter is when you open up the house. We would go all winter with doors, windows wide open. You spend more time outside. The weather's beautiful in the wintertime. So you would think that the flu season in Florida would be opposite, or any place warm. It would be in the summertime when you close up the house and turn on the air conditioning, keep the car windows up, keep the air conditioning on. But it's not true. Everybody gets sick around that same time of year. But it can't have anything to do with weather, and it can't have anything to do with us closing up the house or being, you know, locked in without good, clean airflow. That doesn't make sense. So what is it then? Well, what if we look at some other things that go on from, say, November through March? Aren't there a lot of holidays during that time?
Yeah.
We have Halloween and starting at the end of October. And what does Halloween mean for most people?
Sugar.
It's certainly not a health food holiday, right? It's probably the worst holiday as far as food. I don't even want to call it food. Nobody consumes food on Halloween. They consume mountains and mountains of sugar and additives and junk. And that starts... And then what do we have in November that may not be our healthiest eating time?
Yeah,
we go into Thanksgiving. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then we have Christmas, then we have New Year's, and all of these things, they're really kind of unhealthy. We don't eat that great. We tend to eat a lot more desserts during that time. We tend to drink more during those times. And haven't we read so many articles over the years about how stressful those holidays are. You know, all the stories of, oh my God, I have to be with my family, and, you know, the whole family dynamic through all these parties and holidays, and everybody's stressed out, and Christmas and New Year's and the rush. Could it just be that flu season has nothing to do with the weather and everything to do with our lifestyle?
That's a fascinating look at it, Kevin. It really is. And it'd be kind of good for all of us to step back and think right now, like, how can we go into this season differently, you know, in a different way? Most of us are all eating better, but what about the sleep and the stress and all that? How can we go in there managing it?
Yeah. So I'm totally against the flu vaccine, and they keep expanding the group that should take it. You know, I can remember a decade ago, it was much less common, and they would recommend it for people who really had a compromised immune system. Now it's almost like they're recommending it for everybody. And that's just a really, really bad idea. For a lot of reasons. So that's kind of my little rant. I love the fact that the truck is getting on board and talking more about health. I'm just really disappointed in what most groups are promoting. So let's talk about another topic completely. We've talked about this topic a lot, but we are going to be talking about it a lot more. Bacteria. And, you know, we kind of think of bacteria as being bad. That's the whole germ theory that we've been under for coming up on a century now. I mean, it was the early 1900s when we discovered penicillin and the bacteria and the germ theory. And there's no question that by being able to control some bacterial infections, we have cured a lot of problems, a lot of diseases. There's no question about that. But we've gone way, way overboard. Our thought process was bacteria was bad, and any way that we could wipe out bacteria was a good thing. So penicillin, bacterial cleaners, and it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. We want to disinfect everything. I did a search, and there's like a couple thousand products in Amazon that disinfect things. There are clothes that are antibacterial, and I mean, we're antibacterial everywhere. Well, it turns out, and we're really learning this now, that bacteria are really, really amazing. I just read a book, just finished a book while listening to it, while we're on the road. And I'm not even going to say what the name of the book is because I don't want anybody to go listen to this. It was a hard 12 hours to listen to. It was 12 hours about bacteria. And it was kind of fascinating, but there's not a ton of good practical advice in here. You're not going to get done with this book and have any real advice on what to do. It was just a really interesting, in-depth look into bacteria and all of the things it does. So when we get back from the break, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the book. But then I do have a book recommendation along the same line. It's just not this one. We'll do that right after this break. Stick around. Kevin Ron. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. Kim Cockerham is here with me. We're talking about bacteria. So I listened to 12 hours about bacteria and all of the things that it does and what we've learned about it. And it is amazing stuff. It's like, really, bacteria rule the world. And that's not an exaggeration. Every animal on the planet virtually is more bacteria than they are whatever they are. Like, we have more bacteria in our body than we have of our own body. We've talked about that before. But the way that bacteria works and all the things that it does, it's just amazing. You know, we thought that genetics was going to be the next big frontier in medicine. For the last several decades, they've been so excited about sequencing the entire genome. They thought they were going to find a gene for every disease, and then they could create a drug to fix that gene. And that is a bust. That is not going anywhere at all. Our genes, our genetic code is not even very complicated. There are worms that have more complicated genetics than humans. So that's not really the answer. If it was all about genes, we would be the most complicated species on the planet genetically. But we're not. We're not even close. So it's not really the genes that are that important at all. We have learned that we can turn some genes on and off, and that may be good news, and that may help out in some areas. The other interesting thing I found about genetics in this book was that, you know, we've always believed the theory of evolution. Well, some people do, some don't at all. But if you look at Darwin's theory about natural selection and survival of the fittest, genetic changes happen over tens of thousands of years. They're very, very slow. The interesting thing about bacteria, they can change their genetics instantly. Two different bacteria cells that have two totally different genetics, they can swap genes. And it's unbelievable what they're able to do, and then what animals or humans are able to do because of bacteria. Like, there were just hundreds of examples of animals who lost their entire food supply due to climate change or whatever it might be, and they were able to start eating an entirely different food that would have killed them before. But they were able to do it by picking up a bacteria that could digest the food or detoxify that food, and how fast that can happen. It's really amazing. And there's an example in humans that people of Asian descent are able to digest nori, which is the seafood wrapper that they put on sushi. Humans technically can't digest that. We don't have the enzymes or the ability to digest nori. But Asians started eating it and in the process picked up a bacteria that is able to digest nori. And they can show that people of Asian descent have this bacteria and digest nori, and people who don't really digest it very well. The same thing happens with dairy. Human adults, we should all be lactose intolerant. We were designed to only be able to digest lactose through infanthood, and then when we become adults, we lose that ability. But because certain cultures ate so much dairy, they evolved and picked up the bacteria that allow them to digest dairy. So there's a ton of interesting stuff, but there's also a downside to this. Bacteria are really amazing at what they can do. I mean, they're like little engineers. It's amazing. They can create bone, they can create organs, they can digest foods, they can detoxify foods, they change pretty rapidly. But here's where I see the downside. We're trying to figure out, you know, what is good gut bacteria? The problem is there are hundreds, if not thousands, of species of bacteria, and we have no idea. There really is no such thing as good bacteria or bad bacteria. There's just different levels. You know, H. pylori we thought was bad bacteria, caused ulcers and stomach cancer. Well, it turns out that it protects against GERD and esophageal cancer. And it's getting it in the right balance. Because we thought it was bad, we designed antibiotics to kill it, and it's almost gone. It's actually rare now to find H. pylori in somebody's stomach, but it should be there. And we've kind of wiped it out. Well, now that the path that science is going down, they want to start engineering bacteria, and they can do it. They've engineered E. coli, which we thought, we always hear of E. coli as a bad bacteria, but we all have E. coli in us, lots of different strains. They've engineered bad or just E. coli to seek out other bacteria that may be causing some sort of a bacterial infection. They've been able to engineer, like modify E. coli so that it seeks out this other bacteria and destroys it. I find that kind of scary. I just don't think we should be messing with Nate, because we don't have a very good track record with anything like this.
Yeah. That would be interesting. It just seems like, you know, they find a, you know, they discover something and then they take it to extreme. Oh.
Exactly. Yeah. So here's my book recommendation, which is not the book I've just been talking about, but it kind of is one of the better books I've read about understanding bacteria with really good, useful, everyday advice. The book is called Eat Dirt by Dr. Josh Axe, A-X. He's got a good website. He's got some really good programs. He's all about bacteria, but he's got some really good programs. We've talked about leaky gut and healing the gut and gut healing protocols, and there's a lot of that information in this book. He talks about different types of what's referred to as dysbiosis. Dysbiosis means your gut bacteria is out of whack. It's not the way it should be. It's not balanced. So he talks about healing different kinds of gut problems, which is really nice. Healing candida gut, stressed gut, immune gut, gastric gut, toxic gut. So he really helps you kind of hone in on what your specific gut issue might be and then how to heal that with different protocols. But it's really another one of those books about getting back to being dirty, not being clean. We have become such germophobes, and it's hurting us. It's hurting our health. We lived in the dirt for hundreds of thousands of years. We didn't have soap. We certainly didn't have antibacterial soap. We didn't have antibiotics. We survived because our immune system was strong and it could fight most of these things off. Now we keep weakening our immune system and wiping out all this bacteria, and we're seeing lots of problems. So there's some really good advice in here about, you know, avoiding the antibacterial products, getting out and getting your hands in the dirt and being more dirty. Dogs are really good. Dogs are like little bacterial chauffeurs. They'll go out and run around in nature and pick up the bacteria and bring it back in the house, and it's actually a good thing. So that's the book recommendation, Eat Dirt by Dr. Josh Axe. So what do you say we get to some phone calls?
Perfect. That sounds great. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Let's head off to Long Island. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, Kim. Thank you, Kim, for my order. I got it before I got out of town.
Nice.
Yeah. So, Kevin, I was wondering on the HCL. I know how we do it when we're eating a meal to kind of get our baseline. What do you do? I generally just do bulletproof coffee in the morning. I think a 30-ounce. What do you take when you do the bulletproof coffee in the morning?
You know, I'm not taking any HCL right now. I'm kind of off of it and seeing how things are going. And things seem to be working pretty well. I may retest again in another couple weeks. But when I was taking the HCL, I was taking one with the bulletproof coffee. And I'm not sure that it was really doing much. What I actually, what works better with the Bulletproof Coffee is the bile salts or the bile support, because that's what digests fat. So the HCL is more to digest protein. So we tend to kind of match the HCL with the amount of protein we're eating in a meal. And we match the bile salts or the bile support with the amount of fat in a meal. But I was able to take an HCL with Bulletproof Coffee, and it didn't bother me either. Not sure that it was helping. See, I would try one and see if you notice any difference. And I'm going to come back to you right after this break. Stick around. Get around. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the final segment. Calls are really light today, I think, because we moved time. So I only have a couple more questions. So it looks like we might just be doing 1 hour today. Now, if you're on the line, you've got a question, a comment, a topic, go ahead and press one. And if we get enough of them, maybe we'll do a second hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get back to the calls. We were talking with Steve. Steve, does that help?
Yes, it does. And that makes a lot of sense, because there's so much fat in that Bulletproof Coffee, that bile salt, that makes even more sense, that the liver function and the gallbladder function would probably mean more there. But and like I said, I'm going to try today. I think I'm going to eat me a good substantial meal with a salad and everything, and I'm going to try to get my baseline going on the HCL to where I know about where I'm, you know, I'm at there. But and you said I feel a little pressure basically when I've probably gone one too many, and I can go back off one from that. So if I feel the pressure at number four, then three might be my number to start with and go from there. Is that correct on the HCL?
Yeah. It is. And you know, everybody kind of describes the feeling a little differently. For me, it clearly feels just like pressure right under my sternum. When I take one too many, it feels like pressure. And it's not horribly uncomfortable. In fact, it's not even really uncomfortable at all. I just feel it as this little bit of pressure right beyond my sternum. Some people feel it as heartburn. Some people feel it as a warmth in their stomach, but everybody feels something, and they know when they've gotten to that point. And then, just like you said, one less than that becomes kind of your dose for a meal that size. So if you're eating a substantial meal, let's say it's got, you know, three quarters of your plate is vegetables, and then you've got a little bit of protein, and you put a lot of good fat over all of it, and that's a good substantial meal, and your number turns out to be three. Let's say you took the fourth one while you were eating, you felt that warmth or the pressure, the burning, then you know three is your number for a good substantial meal. And then you just kind of adjust. If you eat a meal half that size, maybe you only need one. And you'll pick this up really quick, though. I mean, everybody does. You get a good feel for what works for you pretty quickly.
Well, I'm getting ready to start doing it regularly. And like I say, I'll report back how it's coming for me. Like I say, I've kind of gotten to that point. And like I say, I've never had really acid reflux. I get a little reflux, but I know the flap's not closing like it ought to. So I have a feeling between you know, lots of this and doing this and getting it, you know, kind of getting it biohacked for myself, you know, I may in a month's time, obviously see some improvement there. And I think everybody said with Debate Plus they've seen some improvements. I'm looking forward to seeing what the changes might be. So I'll report back. I'm trying to do a lot of stuff right now. I want to get real healthy before I get on Medicare. Okay.
Excellent.
Well,
excellent.
Appreciate
there.
You guys,
There you go. We'll look forward to your report back. So here's the thing with stomach acid that I'm finding. Certainly people who have suffered from acid reflux, GERD, heartburn, all of those things definitely benefit from this. I've never had heartburn. I mean, I just don't get any kind of heartburn, reflux, none of that. Reflux, I've never had any of those. And yet my stomach acid was weak. So taking stomach acid helped. I got an email from somebody who said the same thing. They've never had heartburn or acid reflux, but they were able to take three of the extra strength, the stronger ones, before they felt anything. That's an indication that we need more stomach acid. And Kim, you know, we talked about the bacteria, and you know, there are some bacteria that can cause food poisoning and other problems. And our first line of defense against those bacteria, the ones we don't want in our body, is good, strong stomach acid. So, you know, whether or not you have heartburn or GERD or reflux, it's a good idea to try the HCL challenge. And the worst that can happen is you try it and you just don't need it. But so far, everybody that I've talked to that has tried it, and we have a lot of people doing this now, everybody needs it. I mean, everybody's able to take, you know, we've had people that have had to take up to 10 before they feel anything. And that wasn't unusual. When we did this challenge in the NTP program, there were people who got up to 10 and still they weren't feeling anything. I mean, that's a sign of really, really poor stomach acid. But the good news is once you start taking the stomach acid, then your body gets the nutrition it needs from the food you're eating and it starts producing its own. So this is actually a problem we can solve.
Yeah, which is cool. And, you know, I did my test. I'm at three.
Yeah, how did yours go?
I'm at three with it. But you know what my challenge is? I need to have them set in front of me or somewhere. I'm terrible at remembering, you know, getting in that habit of taking them before to get regular on them. Yeah.
Right. So we've talked about habits and how to create habits, and the key to habits is a trigger. So what you need to do is look for some sort of a trigger. That is consistent around eating. So just start paying attention when you sit down to eat or when you go to eat. What is something that you can tie together? Like maybe it's the actual hunger thought. Like, okay, I'm getting hungry, I need to eat. Maybe start tying that thought into HCL. HCL.
Yeah.
Every time you get hungry, think HCL. And that trigger will be what will create the habit of knowing that, okay, I'm going to go eat, grab the HCL, grab the Beta Plus. Yeah. So let's get to some more phone calls. Let's go to Minnesota. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Gary.
I got the gal that I was helping up in Duluth. She got down 36 pounds and she plateaued, whatever. And everything she tried fasting, she'd feel like shit when she was fasting. So I just out of the blue, I just asked her, did you have your gallbladder removed? And she said, yes. I said, well, that's the whole problem, whatever. So I gave her, you know, the two things that we were just talking about there, the hydrochloric acid and the probiotics. I told her to get it.
Right.
Uh-oh.
Gary? Call's still there. Gary?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Oh, boy. Well, I'm going to go to Gary's still there. We'll see if we can come back and save that line, but I'm going to go to New York. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kev. Kim, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
I got an update for you. I called you there a couple of weeks ago. I had the pains in my knees, and you were telling me to watch the protein and all that. So I started watching the protein, and the pain's gone away out of the knees. And if I do get...
Oh, good.
If I do take too much protein, you know, I can feel it pretty much within the day. I can actually feel it in my knees. So I guess that's a good thing. And
good.
I've been watching
good.
That, Just what you were talking there about the gallbladders, we were just over the weekend there was a family get-together, and there was another family came over, and there were seven in the family, and out of the seven, three of them had their gallbladders removed.
Wow.
And they all
were pretty common.
They were very, very obese, and meanwhile, the ones that had their gallbladders, they were all, you know, pretty fit and trim compared to the people who had it taken out. And it was, you know,
interesting.
It's just sad to see the way these people, they just take the load of you, and that's it. But I was, what I was talking about was the in-cab cooking. I was talking to the driver the other day there, and he was saying that he couldn't cook, or he didn't want to cook or whatever, but I think it was just he didn't know how to cook. So a guy I found there, he's on YouTube, he's an English guy, he drives over in Europe, and Luke Vernon is the name of his channel, and he does a whole thing about cab cooking. And he videos it while he's in the truck on a run out of Europe. And a lot of the food is not keto, but I mean, you know, just give you an idea of stuff to do and things. So his channel is Luke Vernon with a V. And it's very, I mean,
okay.
When I drove trucks over in Europe, I used to cook all the time in the truck because you just couldn't afford to eat out every day. I more or less don't do it here because it's, saves you a lot of money and you eat a lot healthier because you're in control of the food.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And, you know, that brings up a really good topic, Kim. I think one of the biggest changes people can make around getting healthy, and this is just in general, this is for everybody, learning how to cook and getting back to preparing own food. I mean, that's really where we've gone wrong, is we're so distant from our food and where it comes from and how it gets prepared. And we want the convenience food, and I get that. But I don't think it's worth it. Convenience is killing us. And I think one of the biggest changes people can make is to get interested in food, learn how to cook, just get started. It's not that complicated. It's fun. And it's a great way to connect with your health. Well, here's your chance, 30 seconds. What do you want to close with today?
Oh, gosh. You got me. I don't know. You guys call me if you need some supplements or want to talk, share your health story, and look forward to talking to you.
And congratulations on getting started on your NTC. That's an exciting journey. I'm going to be excited to be there with you. So we will see you all next time. Thanks for joining us. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Rutherford. Now, I think what we might do, I have a couple calls and people have been holding, so I do want to get to them. I don't think we have enough questions. We may just do one or maybe two segments. So you do have an opportunity here. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic, go ahead and press one, and we'll just keep going until I run out of questions. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. My co-host is Kim Cockerham. This is the show where we take your calls and answer your questions about everything health, fitness, food, nutrition, supplements, diet, exercise, training, disease, drugs, you name it. We'll talk about it here on the show. And of course, we wrap it around that trucking lifestyle, living and eating and trying to stay healthy on the road. And the more we do it, the more we find that it's just not that difficult. Kim, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin. Glad to be here.
You know, I was just saying that, you know, finding ways to do this on the road. Isn't it exciting every week seeing all the stuff the tribe comes up with and how people are getting better and better at this all the time?
It's huge. When I was talking with one of our listeners yesterday, who it just blows my mind, like, he's going into the doctor, but he's going in with this whole knowledge that he's built himself by listening and trying things, and that he's going in knowing exactly what he wants before going in. And I thought, how powerful and empowering that is, because personally myself, I would just go in the doctor and you take what they have, take their questions and, you take what they have to offer. And this time you're going in knowing what you want, what you're looking for. And it's just, I just am so proud of everybody that they've taken control of their health.
Yeah, and people are coming up with just some really creative ideas and finding better ways of staying healthy and eating better on the road. And, at the end of the last show, we were talking about what I think is really one of the keys to being healthy for all of us is we have to get back to being connected to our food. We have to understand what our food is, where it came from, how it was grown or how it was raised. That's step number one. But then step number two is getting back to cooking. And for me, cooking has always been a passion for me. I think I started cooking when I was like 14 or 15. And for a male, that was kind of unusual. I really didn't have any male friends that cooked, but I really loved cooking early on. And it's the way I relax. So I've always had a really close connection to my food. I eat a lot of, food that's made from scratch. But over the last year and a half, I've gotten really much more connected to the quality of those ingredients, where the food's coming from, how it's raised. And, for me, it's kind of exciting because it's almost like discovering a whole new cuisine. Before I might get excited because I would start to learn how to cook Thai food or different cuisines. Well, now all of a sudden, everything's new again because I'm trying to relearn how to cook with all new ingredients. But for me, it's a lot of fun. It's one of my passions anyway. The other thing I find really exciting about right now, even compared to a year and a half ago when I first started this journey, how many new products are available on the market? It's much, much easier now to find grass-fed beef. Just from a year and a half ago, it's much easier to find pastured eggs and pastured animals and, better quality dairy products, maybe, even raw milk or more organic products. And we're also starting to see some convenience foods, and I don't want to go too heavily down that path, but we're starting to see some convenience foods that are really healthy. And it comes down to the ingredients and the label and the way things are made and processed. But I'm really doing a lot of research, and this kind of fits in with what, we've always done here. When it was trucks, I would go out and find, fuel mileage products or maintenance products or technology or whatever it was and do the testing and, find the best of the best. Well, now I'm doing that with food and supplements and, health related stuff. And I'm just really excited about the products I'm starting to see hit the market. One of the projects we're working on, I'm not going to say too much about it right now, but we are working on an expansion of our store and being able to bring a lot of these products to our listeners and make it easy. Because right now I have this list of like 30 different websites. I go here for this product and here for this product and over here for this one. And we're finding really great products. But I would, if I tried to tell everybody what they were and where they were, we'd end up taking the whole show just giving out websites. So our idea now is just like we did with truck stuff, let's find the best of the best and let's put it in our store so it's easy to go find in one place.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that because I just think it'll just be a great service too. And we can get some of your recipes to go with it and we'll be good to go.
Yeah. So I'm having fun with that. And, you know, that whole idea of just getting connected to our food, getting back to better quality ingredients and enjoying it, because that's still a big part of food. You know, there are some people that say we shouldn't, you know, enjoy food so much. That's where we went down the wrong path. Food is just, you know, nourishment. It's just energy. But food is more than that. And I think to try to deny that is a bad idea. I think food is emotional. I think food is comfort. I think food is social. You know, we eat together. We always have. It's a very social time. So I don't think we should turn food into just energy and just nourishment. I do think food should be a part of our life and our culture. And I think if we do that, we get closer to eating healthy. I think the idea of, oh, it's just food, grab whatever, is what has led us down the wrong path. When, you know, one of the best examples of this, I think, is what we've always referred to as the French paradox, because we couldn't understand, we called it a paradox because we couldn't understand why the French could eat so much saturated fat, so many animal products, drink wine every day, and they were healthier than most of the rest of the world. But when you look at their culture and how they approach food, their culture is all about food. They make everything from scratch, and there's so many artisan food makers who do one thing and do it really well, but they're also very, very social about their meals. And they have some things that are a little different. They don't snack. They sit down to meals, and it's a social experience, but they don't do a lot of snacking, and they don't really eat alone, and they don't really eat on the run. And, you know, that's changing now, but they still have a very strong food culture. And I think that's part of it. And I think making food part of our culture is important. We just need to make it real good quality whole food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, what's cool is we can all of us do that with your next meal, you know, with what you're doing is just slow down. You know, Jeff and I were in Italy probably 6-7 years ago. And I think that was one of the biggest things I came away from there was the way they, go about their meals. It was an event, and you never felt rushed at a restaurant. They were actually offended if you were rushing out, because, you know, in here you feel like, you know, you're holding up a table, you got to eat fast. And just savor every bit of it and make it an event. And so, like you said, social. And even if you're by yourself, you know, find that meditative time to really enjoy your meal.
Yeah, you know, there's actually, it's interesting that you mentioned Italy, because there was a group that started there, and they've now really grown. This started back in 1986 in Italy, and it was actually called the slow food movement.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because we all know fast food. Well, this group in Italy started what they called the slow food movement.
Uh-huh.
And it's grown. It's all over the world now. There's a slow food in many, many countries. So you can go to like slowfoodusa.org and find out, you know, what this is all about. But it's about getting back to that, making meals an experience of not just eating just to eat, or eating just because you're hungry, or eating on the run, or, you know, eating under stress. It's about creating experiences around meals. And that started in Italy.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. All right. So let me take a look at the clock here. I think we are just about done with this. There's the music. we're going to get to a break. What do you say we get to some phone calls when we get back?
Oh, that's great.
All right. We'll do that. We're going to get to your calls and questions right after this break. Stick around. Kevin Rogers. welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. Joining me, my co-host and future NTC, Kim Cockerham. Kim, that's exciting. We talked about that last show. You've taken the plunge. You are officially in the NTC program.
Yeah, it's exciting and scares the crap out of me too. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, it took me a while to really, to really step back and say, you know, because it's a commitment, you know, that was study and so forth. But I'm excited to learn. It's always great to keep learning and, you know, bring it back here and work alongside our tribe, getting better and better.
Yeah, you're going to love it. You're going to do great. And I understand one of our listeners, and actually she's more than a listener. She helps out a lot with our team, and she helps out at CMC. Becky Morgan, I understand, is considering through the NTP.
Yeah. She's actually doing some of the primal coaching, too, now. So she's really, really committed as well, and I'm looking forward to it, her doing that as well.
Yeah, the primal coaching, which is Mark Sisson, my son Michael went through that, which is another great program that addresses a lot of the same stuff. There's a lot of crossover of material there as far as diet and nutrition. And then the primal goes even further into really everything about lifestyle, which is really a great thing. It goes into, you know, exercise and movement and sleep and, you know, going back to that, the way that we lived for a very long time. You know, we talk about going back to the diet we ate for a very long time, but this is more about the entire lifestyle, how we move, how we sleep, how we really just everything about how we live, and figuring out what about civilization is hurting us so much. You know, we even call the diseases we have today, we refer to them as diseases of civilization. Prior to the way we live now, those diseases didn't exist. So something about the way we live now is causing them. And really, it's many, many somethings. It's the food, it's, you know, being indoors, it's the clothes we wear, it's everything. So the primal program is really a very big picture, so that's just such a great fit to have both of those.
Right. Yeah, Becky was here in Florida not too long ago, and we got to go to dinner, and it was really, I had looked at that primal coaching, but not, she brought that to me as far as that the whole person, and that was very, very attractive as well. I just think all of that together is just going to be great.
Yeah. What do you say we get some calls and questions?
Sounds perfect.
All right. Let's go to Kentucky. Jake, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind today?
All right. I just started the keto diet here again. I was a little bit more prepared than last time. I'd called you over the weekend and asked you about why I had such a bad reaction, and I think that I figured it out. Even though I drank a lot of water that day, I don't think it was enough, because yesterday was my first full day of, you know, no carbs, and okay, I went through somewhere between 15 and 20 half-liter bottles of water.
Okay. And that's not uncommon. And we haven't talked about this in a while, but there's a clear explanation to what happens when we're eating the standard American diet, or we're eating a high carb diet. Our body stores sugar in two ways. It stores it first as glycogen, and we can store roughly about 2,000 calories or so worth of glycogen. And the glycogen is stored in the muscle, and it's stored there as energy. So when we need instant energy, our body can pull directly from those glycogen stores. Now, once we deplete those, the other way that carbohydrates get stored in our body is as fat. I mean, that's why the more carbs we eat, the fatter we get. because all the excess gets stored as fat. Well, we have to convert it back out of fat to get it as energy, which happens only if you deplete all of those glycogen stores. So once you stop eating the carbs, your body will burn through that glycogen, and then it has to start burning through fat. That's when we get into ketosis. What happens with the water, though, is that for every one molecule of glycogen your body stores, it has to store 3 to 4 molecules of water with it. And when you deplete all the glycogen, you get rid of 3 or 4 times more water than you did glycogen. So this is where the initial weight loss comes in. It's why people are so amazed that in the first week or two, they drop incredible amounts of weight. Now, critics of ketogenic diets say, oh, the weight loss is just water. Well, that's partially true. In the beginning, it is a lot of water weight you lose. And that's why your clothes fit better and you don't feel bloated. And a lot of the joint pain goes away. But you lose a lot of water, and that creates a couple issues. You can start to feel a little dehydrated. You have to take in some more water, but it will also deplete minerals. As we wash out the water, we wash out minerals with it. So you have to replenish the minerals. And that's part of where some of those keto flu symptoms come from.
That was actually my question. I remembered you saying about the minerals before. I just couldn't remember what ones they exactly were. I think it was magnesium and potassium.
Yeah, the three big ones, sodium, which is just salt, sodium, magnesium, and potassium. They're actually all can be salts. Those are the three big ones that we need to keep in balance. You know, as far as food goes, one of the great kind of snacks that really helps with this is like an avocado with lime and salt. The avocado itself has pretty good amounts of magnesium and potassium, and then we add the sea salt, that's the sodium, and that's a nice snack that can help with that mineral balance. But I found when I'm ketogenic, I have to work really hard. I mean, I eat a good, clean diet. I eat a lot of foods that are high in potassium and magnesium. I salt my food with good quality sea salt. And there are times when I still find that I have a mineral imbalance. And one of the quick ways to know is if you're getting muscle cramps. So I was supplementing with a product called Lite Balance, L-Y-T-E. And we are going to get that in our store, by the way, to make it easier to find. And it's just a liquid. It's just a clear liquid. You put like a capful in your bulletproof coffee or a capful in water, and it will give you that balance. The interesting thing about Lite Balance, and I'm actually working with the owner of that company, by the way, I just talked to her the other day on the phone. The interesting thing about minerals, it's almost like the HCL, the stomach acid challenge. There's a quick way to test whether or not you need a mineral. We do a taste test. So if you take a capful of this and you put it in water, and it makes your water taste kind of disgusting, like a little salty and just not good, that's an indication that your body already has enough of those minerals and you don't need to supplement. But if you put in a capful and you can barely taste it, and then you put in another capful and you can still just barely taste it, that's an indication that your body needs it. So it's self-testing, which is kind of cool. Kim, you and I haven't talked about this yet, but I am talking to the owner of this company, and they have a whole line of minerals that you can taste test. And then the cool thing is, the same mineral that you're testing by tasting it is the supplement. So
nice.
It performs both functions. So we're talking about getting, you know, some more of their minerals into our store as well as the Lite Balance. But they have also developed, and I have a sample kit coming because I want to try this. They have developed a smell test for other vitamins, like vitamin A and D. They claim, and I'm doing some research on this, and it's actually making some sense. They claim that if you are deficient in vitamin D, for example, they make a very, very clean form of vitamin D that they claim you can smell it, and based on the way it smells to you, tells us what your levels of vitamin D are.
That's interesting. I had never heard that before, the smell.
I hadn't either. We did do, and you're going to learn this in your NTC program, a big part of the NTC and NTP is what we call neurolingual testing. And I have heard of this before, but you know, once I saw it work, it was really interesting. Neurolingual testing to figure out which supplements you need. And I'll talk about that a little bit when we get back, and we'll get to more of your calls and questions. Stick around. Kevin Hough. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. Kim is here with me. So, Kim, I was talking about neurolingual testing. So, one of the things we do during the functional evaluation is you check around the body, you do different tests for different things and different functions. And then when you find a problem, maybe a hot spot, a spot that's really tender for somebody, when you're doing the physical evaluation, you then take a supplement. So let's say that we believe, you know, somebody does have a really hot gallbladder, like you do the physical palpation of the gallbladder and it's very, very tender. So we know we have a gallbladder problem. Well, then there are multiple different supplements that could help gallbladder issues. And it's interesting that, and I just thought this was so much kind of hocus pocus the first time I heard of this. I was actually a little worried that maybe I was in, you know, a program that I didn't really want to be in. I thought, oh, come on, this can't work.
Yeah.
But you take the supplement and you have the person put the supplement right on their tongue. And if it's a capsule, you actually open the capsule and dump the contents on their tongue. If it's a tablet, you have them kind of chew it a little bit, crush it up on their tongue, and hold it there, and then we retest that spot. And let's say, you know, we do that tenderness rating when we palpate a spot on somebody's body. We have them give us a number between 0 and 10. 0 is, yeah, I know you're pressing on something, but I don't really feel anything at all. 10 is like you have a very fresh bruise and you're poking your finger right into it. Kind of that level of pain would be a 10. And let's say that they're on the gallbladder, they score a 7. And that's pretty high. So they're feeling some tenderness. You put this supplement on the tongue and retest. And what we look for is we want that number to be cut in half. If we can get that tenderness rating down in half, then that's going to be a good supplement for them. And it was so interesting to watch this over and over and over and have it done on me that some supplements just did nothing. And then another supplement, like the tenderness went away almost immediately. One of them that just my body really seemed to like, and it was interesting because might be very different areas of the body that was responding to this one particular supplement, and it was IPS. It's one of the gut healing supplements. Like it was almost no matter what the hot spot was in my body, when I put the IPS on my tongue, one, it tasted good. Even though it was this chalky kind of powder, It tasted good to me, and my tenderness would go away. So that was an indication that even though I was seeing tenderness in different areas of my body, maybe all of it relates back to the gut healing. So that IPS was a really good gut healing supplement. But the idea of tasting this and having that tenderness go away was so bizarre to me. But I went and did a lot of research on this, and it's really doesn't surprise me anymore. Our bodies are that intelligent. I mean, that's how we knew what to eat for centuries. Our body told us what to eat. You know, it would, something that tasted bad, we wouldn't eat. Something that tasted good, we would want more of it. And when all of our food was natural, that was a really good system. It worked perfectly and beautifully, and our cravings were good signs. There are cultures where women, when they get pregnant, they actually eat dirt. They eat clay, crave it, and they're craving it because of the minerals. The problem today is we can't trust our cravings because they've been hijacked by a lot of fake and engineered foods. But if we get back to eating naturally again and eating real food, we can start to trust our body and trust our taste. And that's really all this neurolingual testing is. It's just using our body's own intelligence to tell us what we need to fix it.
Yeah, very, very cool. But that'll be interesting to see when you get into more of the smell test to see what that brings about.
Yeah, I have those coming, so we're going to start doing some testing on those. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's go to Georgia. Tracy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good.
I just got some blood work done, and I was just a little curious. My husband and I are on the keto diet, and we've been doing it for about a year now. And, of course, the doctor is saying I have high cholesterol. So I just wanted to get your take on it.
Okay. Do you have all of your numbers available?
I do.
Okay.
Go ahead. The total cholesterol is 296.
Okay, go ahead. Let me. I'm opening up. I've got a spreadsheet that I created. So give me your total.
It's 296.
And your HDL.
It's 74.
And your LDL.
Is 202.
And your triglycerides.
100.
Okay. And there are a couple things. I mean, these numbers can tell us something. But we have to know how to look at them. So if we look at your total cholesterol in the traditional way that they look at it, they're going to freak out. 296
right.
Sounds really high. The problem with this number makes absolutely no sense. We're taking three totally different numbers and adding them together, and what we get is garbage because one of those numbers we want to be higher, one of those numbers we want to be lower, and one of those numbers we have to look at completely differently. So 296 is high, no question, but it's a meaningless number, completely meaningless, and you are a great example. If we look at your total cholesterol, you would be considered high risk. If we look at your LDL, you would be considered high risk. But if we look at your ratios, your ratio of total cholesterol to HDL, yours isn't that bad. We want to be under 5, and you're at 4. The lower we go, the better. Before is in the totally normal range. If we look at your HDL to LDL ratio, yours is excellent. I mean, yours is really good. You have a very good level of HDL. If we look at your triglyceride to HDL ratio, yours is ideal. We want to be under 4, and the best is under 2, and your triglyceride to HDL ratio, which the doctors who understand cholesterol say this is probably the most important ratio. Remember, under 4 is good. Under 2 is excellent. You're at 1.3.
Okay.
So
that's great, man. Okay.
The numbers that you show as bad are the numbers that mean nothing. When we look at the ratios that actually tell us something, your numbers all look really good.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. I was a little concerned, and I knew that, you know, sometimes they say that they're a little high and they're really not. So that's why I wanted to call you and get your opinion.
Now, here's another interesting thing. Even though we don't like to use that total cholesterol number, we'd rather use the ratios, and your ratios look excellent. But if we look at that total cholesterol number and we look at all of the data all shows that as we get older, and this is even more true of women, as we get older, the higher your cholesterol number is, the longer you're going to live, and the lower your chances of dementia.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
So I
think your numbers look fantastic.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I appreciate you taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Kim, isn't that that was a really good example there of she had two numbers that the medical community looks at, and they're off the charts high. I mean, 296 is high cholesterol, no question, when based on what we've always been told. But the interesting thing is she's very high in those two numbers, but her ratios are some of the best I've seen.
When we come back, I just read something on that as well too, that I'm shaking my head.
Let's do that when we get back, because that was a great example of looking at the numbers the right way. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. Kim is here with me, and we were just talking about cholesterol numbers. And Kim, I think you had something you wanted to add to that. Uh-oh. What did I do to Kim? Oh, I put her on hold. Why did I do that? Kim, there you are.
You muted me.
I did.
It's funny. I've had to mute myself. I got a cold. I had to mute myself a couple times here, but I keep checking.
Yeah.
I was reading Dr. Kim Noakes' memoir. It's called Challenging Beliefs, and it's fascinating because I just really like reading him. I like hearing him talk. He's just so real, and he addresses the fact, you know, because he did have a change in belief in the way he looked at things, but that what he specifically was saying, too, it was like after age 50, 51, that increased levels actually decreasing levels of cholesterol, falling blood cholesterol after age 51 actually were associated with an 11% increase in overall mortality. And and especially women. And you said that. I mean, especially women. And so it's just fascinating that I still would freak out if I saw, you know, a high number, because it's hard changing that whole thought process around cholesterol. And there's so many other things, you know, he talks about, you know, hypertension and diabetes and so forth that we should be focusing on, and not this cholesterol.
And you know, the thing that I've read a lot of different doctors about this, and the thing is, these ideas and this, the proof and you know, looking at cholesterol completely differently is not coming from, you know, bloggers or, you know,
right.
It's coming from very highly credentialed doctors with lots and lots of data to back this up. The problem is they're fighting a system that wants to push cholesterol drugs because they're so profitable.
Yeah. Right.
That it's hard to get that message out. You know, the big pharmaceutical companies have a gazillion dollars to spread their message. And these doctors are individuals. They're usually able to get their message out by writing a book, and the book becomes popular. But, you know, we're not here. I'm not here as an NTP saying, oh, I know about cholesterol and doctors don't. The information that you and I are talking about is coming from very highly credentialed doctors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who are taking a stance, which, you know, a lot of them have been ostracized by their own community and peers, you know, and they're fighting back too because they just know it's right.
Well, the author and doctor you just mentioned, Tim Noakes, was put on trial in South Africa.
Yeah.
They took him to court and he was on trial for his advice. There was another doctor, a female doctor in Sweden, who was brought up in front of a tribunal, a court. And the interesting thing was she won. The medical community in Sweden that was challenging her and saying she had to stop giving that advice to eat high fat, low carb, she won. She had the proof to say what she was doing was right. So you're right. These doctors are taking a big risk, to the point that they're being taken to court over this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they're winning. That's the good news.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to, let's do a speed round here and try to get to as many calls as we can before we've got to wrap this. Robert, go ahead.
Hey, Kim. Hey, Kevin.
Hey there.
Hey, Robert.
Hey, I just started the keto diet, and I was wondering if there was a general number for amount of grams for protein or fat. I know carbs keep it under 20, so I was just wondering if y'all had any information about that.
You know, just I like to start off with some really, really general numbers and then tweak from there because everybody's a little different. You're right on the 20 grams. If you stay under 20 grams of carbs in the beginning, that will put you into ketosis. That puts everybody into ketosis. And then once you're in ketosis and you lose the weight and you see some of the other benefits, I like the idea of adding as many good carbs back into the diet as we can and still stay where we want to stay as far as weight and how we feel. And when I say good carbs, I'm talking vegetables and even starchy vegetables and resistant starches, adding those back in. And you know, originally we thought that vegetables were really healthy because of their nutrition. But honestly, when you stack vegetables up against most animal products, they're not all that nutritious. Clearly, we get some vitamins and minerals, but I think what we're really starting to find comes back to the gut bacteria. Vegetables feed our gut bacteria really well. So people and societies who eat a lot of plant material tend to have really healthy gut microbiomes, and that seems to help so many areas of our health. So I do like, go very, very low carb in the beginning, get yourself into ketosis, lose the weight, hit all your goals, and then start adding as many good carbs as you can back in. So that's how I feel on the carb side. Protein, just to give you a number, I think in the beginning, stay under 100 grams of protein a day. There are calculations based on body weight. And I'm not big on complicated formulas. I say keep it under 100 in the beginning. And then again, start experimenting with it. And you know, we certainly don't want to overdo the protein, but as long as we're eating good, high quality protein, and if we're trying to get things like organ meats, if we can handle them, they're superfood, sardines and wild salmon and things like that. Those are all high in protein, but they're very high in nutrition. So keep it under 100 grams. Try to keep your protein as nutritious and clean as possible. And on the fat, I put no number on this whatsoever, no limit. Eat as much fat as you want. The reason I can say that is because fat is self-regulating. The more fat you eat, the less of everything else you're going to eat. Fat is so satisfying to the appetite, and fat is such a great energy source that I haven't really found anybody who overdoes the fat. It's the other two. If you focus on those other two, make up the rest of your calories with fat. Eat when you're hungry and don't eat when you're not.
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Minnesota.
Yep.
Gary,
hello.
Are you there?
Yep,
okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
All right.
You
I had started before. The gal that I was helping in Duluth, I found out that she didn't have a gallbladder. She was feeling shit when she was fasting and stuff, so I just asked her straight out, did she ever have her gallbladder taken out? And she said, yeah, many years ago. So just trying to figure out, I got her to get the right bile salts and stuff, and my mom also doesn't have a gallbladder. Just trying to figure out how many bile salts should she take while, you know, for a meal.
You know, this is kind of the same as the HCL. The test isn't quite as clear, but this is kind of one of those areas where you've got to figure out how much each person needs and how much they need at each meal. I would start with one capsule a meal and see if you feel any difference in digestion. And then I would start adding. I wouldn't do it the way we do the HCL, where we keep adding at that same meal till we feel it. Because with the bile salts, you're not going to feel it. So we do it a little different on this. Take one at your first meal. Maybe take two at the next meal. Maybe keep increasing. What you want to watch for, though, if you get too many bile salts, you're going to get diarrhea. That's the only real side effect of this. And it takes a little longer for that to happen. So we can't do it the way we do the HCL, trying to do it all at once. So start with one, then increase it, and you'll find that point where you go, oh, yeah, you know, I think that was too many. And then just back off from there.
Okay. All right, sounds good.
And the other thing, now when you're talking about people with no gallbladder, they will have to stay on the bile salts forever. We also recommend people who have a gallbladder starting with the bile salts. And we don't want to stay on the bile salts forever if we have a gallbladder, because we will become dependent on the bile salts and our gallbladder will stop functioning well. So I recommend going through one full round of the bile salts, one bottle, and then switch over to the gallbladder support supplement that doesn't have the bile salts. And then most people will find that is a good enough supplement. They don't ever have to go back to the bile salts. But if you do have to go back to the bile salts, we recommend cycling them. But I think if you're eating a good, clean, whole food diet and doing all the right things, that one round of the bile salt kind of jump starts things, and then the gallbladder support will be enough. Kim, we're all out of time. Anything you want to wrap up with?
Yeah, no, just thanks for being here, everybody. Have a great week. Take care of yourself.
All right, great stuff. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Be safe, be profitable, fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Robinson. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you this weekend for the live show.